serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, getting you ready for Election Day with a reminder to vote and a few reasons why that right should not be taken lightly, given the price that's been paid to preserve that right throughout our nation's history. For the final veteran you'll hear from today, it's that time of the year where his story always comes to mind for me. At hometownheroesradio.com, I have a link to the book 11-2, as in November 2nd, a key date on the calendar in several ways for Frank Kravitz. He had enlisted in the Army Air Corps on November 2, 1943, and exactly 1 year later, on November 2, 1944, he was ready for his sixth mission as a B-17 tail gunner with the 457th Bomb Group. Little did he know, his bomber would be one of 69 planes that the Germans shot down that day.
Well, we took off at 8 o'clock, about 8 o'clock in the morning. By the time we got rendezvous, our poop, and got in position for this bombing stream going to our target, we flew around at different altitudes, and we're just going around and around and around, you know. And once we got to 15,000 feet, where we went on oxygen, we were getting close to France or something like that, you know, where the Germans were. And we weren't on oxygen up till then. The anticipation comes when you see the black smoke coming up, if it's flak, you know. And somebody else ahead sees that, so they're telling us, you know, enemy fire up ahead, you know. So you got over 1,000 bombers in the air, a stream going in, you know. Yeah. So unfortunately, when our pilots, they opened the bomb bay doors and get ready for attack, and that, you know, we dropped our bombs and we turned off the target. And shortly after we turned off the target, we were attacked.
When you say attacked, you're not talking about the flak anymore. You're talking about German fighters coming right at you. And you saw them? Did someone else tell you they were coming, or were you the one who saw them?
3 o'clock high. Yeah. You know, saw them coming.
How many of them?
3 abreast, you know. And I saw the cannon fire coming out of the wings for the last seconds, you know. And I fired back at them when I was still alive, you know.
And you shot one of them down?
I got credit for it. Somebody else in the other crew said that the tail gunner shot down a plane. So I have the citation for that. When the second wave of planes came in, I was had my target on the planes, and all of a sudden there was an explosion in the tail end of the section, and it filled up with smoke. And of course, being at that high altitude and the holes that were in a plane and everything else, the air cleared up real quick. So there I am, realized that I was wounded. I got on my throat mic and I called it to the crew pilot, tail gunner crew, I'm hit. I'm pushing on the button, the throat mic, and trying to report to him. I get no answer. As it happened, find out later on, this was all shot out, the whole communication system. So whenever, the only way they communicated up front, the flight engineer were hollering back into the plane as loud as they could, giving orders and what to do. They chopped out the, this tells them just later on. They got a hatchet and chopped the ball turret out and dropped that, threw all the ammunition out. They were throwing the ammunition out and everything else to lighten the plane up, you know.
I want people to understand what the situation is here. So you're on this airplane that is barely making it, that is not going to make it, and there's a real chance you aren't going to make it. You're wounded severely. You can't get yourself out of this plane, so you needed your fellow crew members to save your life, right?
After they dragged me through from the tail of the ship into the radio room, which was like a cabinet, you know, so that they could talk. And you didn't have the noise in here in the radio room, you know. So when I was on the floor, they looked at my wound and everything. They put sulfa powder on it, made compresses on it, you know, wrapped it real tight and gave me morphine and other sedatives. It was in the first aid kit, you know. And I was awake.
What was going through your head?
I had no idea. The thing is, as things were happening, and I'd say to myself, all I was doing is trying to remember what's going on, unconsciously, yeah. You know, observing everything that's going on. And that's why I have such a vivid picture of it. What's ahead, I don't know. It's just happening there. You're looking at it, and I remember it, you know.
So you couldn't walk.
you couldn't bail out yourself, and there and the captain's given the order to bail out, right?
Yeah, the captain gave the order to bail out, and they took care of me first. And they got me over to the door, put the chute on me, popped the chute in the floor, and put it in my arms and tossed me out. I just didn't take long for the chute to open up, you know. Quite a jolt, by the way.
Well, yeah, so they actually pulled the ripcord before they pushed you out of the plane. So then it's opening immediately when you pop out of that plane.
Yeah. It was happening. I wasn't thinking about it. My mind was just recording it, that's all.
So you had a pretty long way down to the ground. Were you conscious? Were you looking around you? What did you see?
At first, I thought I was going up. You know, and honest to God, I said, geez, this thing's going up, you know. And then all of a sudden, the ground started coming up to me, meet me, you know. And then there were dwellings around the area, and there was farms and everything else.
And what happened when you hit the ground?
I tumbled like a jackrabbit. I tumbled down the hill. Yeah. A few steps like that, because it was on a little hill like this, and I just boom, 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 boom. You know. I know their instructions were to hold your feet up and it's like you got, but easier said than done, you know, especially if you're wounded, you know.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even think of that, you know.
Well, and I've talked to some POWs who tried to hide or avoid capture, and most of them, you know, maybe they lasted a few hours, but they were eventually captured. And in your case, there wasn't much you could do because you couldn't move unless you dragged yourself with your arms, huh?
Yeah. I had no motion at all. I had to be on a stretcher or a bed somewhere, and that was it, you know.
But there was another situation here where somebody saved your life because there were some civilians you'd been bombing that wanted to take your life, right?
The civilians were coming in a distance, and they came close enough that I saw they had pitchforks and that in their hands, and that, and they threw Germans fired a couple rounds, and they went back to where that house was. That they eventually took me anyway, you know, took me to the farmhouse where the Hitler Youth took care of me. You know.
So that night, you spent the night in a cow barn, unable to move, guarded by two members of the Hitler Jugend. I can't imagine what that felt like. And even after they got you to a hospital, you don't know how much they really want to take care of you. You don't speak their language. And there was a real fear that you might lose your leg.
Well, I said when I lay was on the table and the flying nun that was just attending to the doctor, you know, that the thing in the table wasn't more than 3 feet wide and about belly high, you know, where I was laying on, maybe chest high or right here. And none was looking straight at my face, you know. I don't know what the procedure was, but I know they put a container on my nose and told me to count. And I remember counting to about 100.
You wanted to know if they were going to cut off your leg, so you motioned?
And then none was beside me, and I made motions with my hand if they were going to amputate. And the nun says, nine. I already knew because my mother spoke German, so different words that I didn't know from that, you know. And I just had no thoughts more, but somebody's taking care of me, do with me what thou wilt.
But when you came to after that operation, what was the first thing you did?
Well, I took my hand, started my hip, and went down the side and see if I still had a leg. Because I thought the Germans were historically amputations were the easiest way out. So that's what had happened. And I went down my leg and it's like that. And they patched me up the best they could. And I don't know what the drugs they used on me or anything else. But they comforted me enough that a couple of days later I was taken on a train to the interrogation center in Dulagluft for down fires.
So they didn't amputate. They took care of you. So here you have a situation. A, the civilians basically have a lynch mob and they want to take you out, and these German guards shoot their gun in the air to save your life, and then these medical professionals save your leg and get you fixed up. Looking back now, how does that make you feel to know that these people on the other side of the war, your enemies, took such good care of you?
Well, I think later finding out that because we had been taking care of down German flyers, bringing them to the United States, and taking care of them. They know what they got in the United States, German flyers here in the country, what good service they were getting, you know. I think that reflected back to us where we didn't get treated as miserable. What do you call it, camaraderie between flyers? Yeah, you know. So that prevailed.
So you spent a lot of time just healing up, but then you still had to spend time in a couple different prisoner of war camps. I know you were about 175 pounds or so when you went into the service.
When I signed up, I weighed 175 pounds. I had to be 170 to get into the Air Force. So I went back to my football coach, went down to the football field, and I worked out with a football team, you know, all during the summer with him. My stepmother's angry at me because I'm not eating. I don't want to eat. I just went on a diet, and I was determined I'm going to get in the Air Force, and I'm going to lose this weight, and I'm going to get in. So I did, you know.
A little more than a year after you were losing weight to get in the service, you were starting to lose weight, not by choice, because as a prisoner, you just didn't have much food. What was the worst of that? What was the hardest thing to deal with that element of your captivity?
Well, example to that is, I'll put it this way. One day, I was out there. They put me in an upper bunk because I'm not going to be ambulatory for a long time. They brought another down flyer in a bed next to me. We had our pleasantries, and he was in bad shape and everything else, you know. But we brought our food out. It was meager as it was, you know. I ate it, you know. And he's screaming, "I can't eat this crap," you know. I says, "Well, what are you going to do with it, you know?" He says, "You want it?" I says, "Yeah, I'll take it." They passed it over to me, and I ate it. You know, a couple of days of that, no more food came over. he needed it. You know, but that was a part of it. I said, "Give me all you got." You know.
Did you ever eat the infamous bread made out of mostly sawdust?
Did I? I sure did. In fact, if you give me your address, I'm going to send you, it was in our POW magazine, a copy of the ingredients.
The recipe, let me guess, there's a lot of tree flour, right?
Yeah. In fact, they use the outer bark, it seems like.
You didn't mind because it was something to eat?
Well, absolutely.
Did you ever think of escaping?
No, I don't think I ever did. With that many people, you know, guns are there, they're going to open fire on you. But first of all, there was a 10-foot warning wire inside and a 20-foot wire outside and barbed wire in that empty space. Now, many of the guys lost their life by trying to get through that maze because they got fired on right away anyway. And then the tunnel bit and everything else. I didn't see any of that kind of stuff, but it's historically, they did dig tunnels.
And how much did you weigh when you were liberated?
118 pounds.
So all these months, you're wasting away. You don't have enough to eat. You don't know when the war is going to be over or that your side's going to win. What gave you hope? Where did that come from? How did you believe that there was still a life out there for you?
I believed in the good Lord would take care of me. It's all whatever becomes of me. You never thought you were going to die, or for that matter. You know, you're living, so you live. And who knows when you're going to die anyway, you know.
And all this time, your family had no idea what had happened to you?
No.
Well, and obviously, the fact that we're sitting here talking, and the fact that that you have three children and five grandchildren, none of them would have been here if you didn't make it through all this, if you didn't survive, if you weren't eventually liberated. And sounds like there's a pretty good story about the day of your liberation and some things that you saw that you'll never forget. This was in Moosburg, Germany.
Well, I arrived at this camp from our long march from Nuremberg to Moosburg, Germany.
How long was the march?
90 kilometers. It took us about 15 or 16 days to walk, you know.
With anything to eat or no?
Yeah, we had whatever we could scrounge, you know. There were Germans that had potatoes, and somebody had something, could barter with them. And whatever we saved to go on the trip that we had in the sack to sustain us, you know.
You're in Nuremberg, and you march 16 days to Moosburg.
And when we got inside of Moosburg, it was already crowded from other camps being vacated, and the things, us men coming in, the prisoners coming into the same compound. So it ended up, historically, it says that they were over 100,000 all nationality prisoners of war, Germans, French, whatever, at this camp. And on April 29th, our senior officer in charge of the United States Army that were opposing the Germans that were protecting their prisoners, and they were about to release them, they sent a group to the German groups there, the white flags and that. They come back, and the Germans refused. They're going to attack the camp. So, and we didn't know this, but that's the historically what it was, you know. So it was about 9 o'clock in the morning on April 29th that the fire started. Our tanks start coming down over the hill. We saw them, and then all kind of vehicles, you know, and so much fire, you know, was going. And I guess the confrontation lasted maybe about an hour and a half. And our people inside says, lay on the ground, get under the barracks, get it done, because the fire's going on. And just hoping they're shooting at our troops, and we're getting the residuals of it, you know, from in the air, you know. Some fellas were hurt, you know, from it, you know. Shortly before noon, we saw the flag go up over Mooseburg.
When you say a flag, this is somewhere where there had been a swastika flying, but the new flag was?
American flag.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then all the shouting and everything was going on, you know. And it wasn't shortly after that that Patton, our troops came up to the gate, and then Patton came, followed in right away and rode up on his big white tank, you know. Not white tank, but he looked like God anyway.
White gloves and pearl pistols, I'm sure.
Mayhem, you know, tears, you know, kissing ground and everything, hugging and everything else. And it said, we're going home, everything we could think about. And it didn't take long, though.
Just imagining or seeing in your mind's eye that American flag going up and Patton's forces coming through the gate brings all those emotions back for you, doesn't it?
Yes. I told the dear Lord, if you let me get out of this predicament that I'm in, I'll never complain in my life. And I've done that.
And if he didn't complain, what does that mean for the rest of us? Frank Kravitz, Francis Asbury, Ruben Ramirez, three World War II veterans whose memories underscore the incredible price that's been paid for our freedom. Our right to vote this week is something we could easily take for granted, but I hope that after listening to what they lost, what they sacrificed, what they endured, that the rest of us can live in such a way that builds the kind of value that may someday match the price. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler saying it one more time. Freedom is not free.